Life is complex. Join us for the simple gifts of wisdom, love, and delight in the written word. The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Part 2 on the Man Called Christ. Chapter 4, The Witness of the Heretics.
Part 3.
Those that are supposed to derive from the mysterious Manes are called Manichaean. Kindred cults are more generally known as Gnostic. They are mostly of a labyrinthine complexity. But the point to insist on is the pessimism. The fact that nearly all, in one form or another, regarded the creation of the world as the work of an evil spirit. Some of them had that Asiatic atmosphere that surrounds Buddhism, the suggestion that life is a corruption of the purity of being. Some of them suggested a purely spiritual order, which had been betrayed by the coarse and clumsy trick of making such toys as the sun and moon and stars. Anyhow, all this dark tide out of the metaphysical sea in the midst of Asia poured through the dikes simultaneously with the creed of Christ. But it is the whole point of the story that the two were not the same, that they flowed like oil and water. That creed remained in the shape of a miracle, a river still flowing through the sea. And the proof of the miracle was practical once more. It was merely that while all that sea was salt and bitter with the savor of death, of this one stream in the midst of it, a man could drink. Now that purity was preserved by dogmatic definitions and exclusions. It could not possibly have been preserved by anything else. If the church had not renounced the Manichaeans, it might have become merely Manichaean. If it had not renounced the Gnostics, it might have become Gnostic. But by the very fact that it did renounce them, it proved that it was not either Gnostic or Manichaean. At any rate, it proved that something was not either Gnostic or Manichaean. And what could it be that condemned them if it was not the original good news of the runners from Bethlehem and the trumpet of the resurrection? The early church was ascetic, but she proved that she was not pessimistic, simply by condemning the pessimists. The creed declared that man was sinful, but it did not declare that life was evil, and it proved it by damning those who did. The condemnation of the early heretics is itself condemned as something crabbed and narrow, but it was, in truth, the very proof that the church meant to be brotherly and broad. It proved that the primitive Catholics were specially eager to explain that they did not think man utterly vile, that they did not think life incurably miserable, that they did not think marriage a sin or procreation a tragedy. They were ascetic because asceticism was the only possible purge of the sins of the world. But in the very thunder of their anathemas, they affirmed forever that their asceticism was not to be anti-human or anti-natural, that they did wish to purge the world and not destroy it. And nothing else except those anathemas could possibly have made it clear amid a confusion which still confuses them with their mortal enemies. Nothing else but dogma could have resisted the riot of imaginative invention with which the pessimists were waging their war against nature, with their eons and their demiurge, their strange logos, and their sinister Sophia. If the church had not insisted on theology, it would have melted into a mad mythology of the mystics, yet further removed from reason, or even from rationalism, and, above all, yet further removed from life and from the love of life. Remember that it would have been an inverted mythology, one contradicting everything natural in paganism, a mythology in which Pluto would be above Jupiter, and Hades hang higher than Olympus, in which Brahma and all that has the breath of life would be subject to Siva, shining with the eye of death. That the early church was itself full of an ecstatic enthusiasm for renunciation and virginity makes this distinction much more striking, and not less so. It makes all the more important the place where the dogma drew the line. A man might crawl about on all fours like a beast because he was an ascetic. He might stand night and day on the top of a pillar and be adored for being an ascetic. But he could not say that the world was a mistake or the marriage state a sin without being a heretic. What was it that thus deliberately disengaged itself from Eastern asceticism by sharp definition and fierce refusal, if it was not something with an individuality of its own, and one that was quite different? If the Catholics are to be confused with the Gnostics, we can only say it was not their fault if they are. And it is rather hard that the Catholics should be blamed by the same critics for persecuting the heretics, and also for sympathizing with the heresy. The Church was not a Manichaean movement, if only because it was not a movement at all. It was not even merely an ascetical movement, because it was not a movement at all. It would be nearer the truth to call it the tamer of asceticism than the mere leader or loosener of it. It was a thing having its own theory of asceticism, its own type of asceticism, but most conspicuous at the moment as the moderator of other theories and types. This is the only sense that can be made, for instance, of the story of St. Augustine. As long as he was a mere man of the world, a mere man drifting with his time, he actually was a Manichaean. It really was quite modern and fashionable to be a Manichaean. But when he became a Catholic, the people he instantly turned on and rent in pieces were the Manichaeans. The Catholic way of putting it is that he left off being a pessimist to become an ascetic. But as the pessimists interpreted asceticism, it might be said that he left off being an ascetic to become a saint. The war upon life, the denial of nature, were exactly the things he had already found in the heathen world outside the church, and had to renounce when he entered the church. The very fact that St. Augustine remains a somewhat sterner or sadder figure than St. Francis or St. Teresa only accentuates the dilemma. Face to face with the gravest or even grimmest of Catholics, we can still ask, why did Catholicism make war on Manichees, if Catholicism was Manichaean? Take another rationalistic explanation of the rise of Christendom. It is common enough to find another critic saying, Christianity did not really rise at all. That is, it did not merely rise from below. It was imposed from above. It is an example of the power of the executive, especially in despotic states. The empire was really an empire. That is, it was really ruled by the emperor. One of the emperors happened to become a Christian. He might just as well have become a Mithraist, or a Jew, or a fire worshiper. It was common in the decline of the empire for eminent and educated people to adopt these eccentric Eastern cults. But when he adopted it, it became the official religion of the Roman Empire. And when it became the official religion of the Roman Empire, it became as strong, as universal, and as invincible as the Roman Empire. It has only remained in the world as a relic of that empire. Or, as many have put it, it is but the ghost of Caesar still hovering over Rome. This also is a very ordinary line taken in the criticism of orthodoxy, to say that it was only officialism that ever made it orthodoxy, and here again we can call on the heretics to refute it. The whole great history of the Arian heresy might have been invented to explode this idea. It is a very interesting history often repeated in this connection. And the upshot of it is that insofar as there ever was a merely official religion, it actually died because it was a merely official religion. And what destroyed it was the real religion. Arius advanced a version of Christianity which moved, more or less vaguely, in the direction of what we should call Unitarianism, though it was not the same, for it gave to Christ a curious intermediary position between the divine and human. The point is that it seemed to many more reasonable and less fanatical, and among these were many of the educated class in a sort of reaction against the first romance of conversion. Arians were a sort of moderates and a sort of modernists. And it was felt that after the first squabbles, this was the final form of rationalized religion into which civilization might well settle down. It was accepted by Divus Caesar himself and became the official orthodoxy. The generals and military princes drawn from the new barbarian powers of the north, full of the future, supported it strongly. But the sequel is still more important. Exactly as a modern man might pass through Unitarianism to complete agnosticism, so the greatest of the Arian emperors ultimately shed the last and thinnest pretense of Christianity. He abandoned even Arius and returned to Apollo. He was a Caesar of the Caesars, a soldier, a scholar, a man of large ambitions and ideals. Another of the philosopher kings. It seemed to him as if at his signal the sun rose again. The oracles began to speak like birds, beginning to sing at dawn. Paganism was itself again. The gods returned. It seemed the end of that strange interlude of an alien superstition. And indeed it was the end of it, so far as there was a mere interlude of mere superstition. It was the end of it, insofar as it was the fad of an emperor, or the fashion of a generation. If there really was something that began with Constantine, then it ended with Julian.
'Tis the gift to be simple. 'Tis the gift to be free. 'Tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we will not be ashamed. To turn, turn, will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right.